passionate, obviously, and he's not here. However, we still have a panel, a very strenuous panel of three people who've been introduced already. I won't introduce them again, but we have Professor Frank V. Baer, we have Dr. Bettina Langer, and we have Professor Alain Jeunetre. So, coming from very different perspectives and angles.
Kira as well. She wasn't supposed to originally, but...
Oh, sorry, Kira, are you willing to speak, are you? You're very welcome.
I'll let everyone else go first so I can think.
Oh, no, that's good. No, I just, you're not on the... I didn't realize. I know we had...
I dropped back in.
You dropped back in. Oh, I wasn't told. Well, anyhow, that's great. Yes, so we've got four panelists. What's your background in? What discipline?
Environment.
Environment. Okay. Oh, that's good. Well, let's just follow the order here. So, without more ado, Frank, you have 15 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. Let me go back to the recent past and Max's paper. I interpreted Max's paper as saying that we, in the light of regulatory failure in particular, that we need some new organising concept or umbrella concept for discussing regulation and regulatory failure. And the one he has put forward to contemplate on is the idea of regulatory capture. And he suggests we can take this off the shelf, dust it down, expand it, revamp it, and that will be our new way into this subject. And in his paper, he concludes that, yes, this is a valuable way of looking at regulation. I think listening to him, he put it more as a question mark. Is this a valuable way of looking at it? And I think left it as a question. And I think I would tend to also go along with the questioning side of things. I think capture may be an issue, but I think regulators are perfectly well able to go wrong themselves without reaching for capture as a reason they go wrong. And I think we've seen in the financial crisis that it's behaviour of people in the market themselves that causes market failure. We've only got to look at all the cases in the US about representations and warranties to see all the people who misrepresented contracts and the pricing which came out of them. So there are many reasons for market failure, and one doesn't really need to place that much weight that economists have tended to do on regulatory capture. Now, Max is far too polite and cautious to want to say what he's also implicitly rejecting as other organising concepts. And I will be less polite, and I will say what I think is being rejected. One is the umbrella of risk-based regulation. Now, why would one reject that? Because it has been very fashionable. And I think there are two reasons. One is that it failed. Risk-based regulation failed in the financial sector. And that was probably what was in Max's mind. And the other thing is there are so many different interpretations that can be given to risk, it has really become a rather useless organising concept. And, well, I won't say more. What other organising concept would be useful and has been around? Well, with due deference to our law and sociology people, a responsive regulation, of course, has been used to organise an awful lot of discussion about regulation. And I think possibly the reasons Max has not gone in that direction is partly it's very much compliance-focused. And Max has been very interested in the inception of crises, what went wrong with the thinking originally, before you even get to questions of compliance. And I think also the problem of the much of the law and sociology approach, and here I'm making a sweeping generalisation, is it's building a concept of the regulatory world from the inside out. How do regulators view it? How do those regulated view it? And this just leaves, in my mind, far too much out of the equation, out of the picture. So I think Max is essentially saying these ways of looking at regulation in some ways belong to the past and we need something new. And he's suggested regulatory capture, but then put a question mark about it. Now, are there some alternatives? Well, one thing which has been mentioned here is, are there any alternatives that come out of game theory? And I simply don't know what the answer is to that. I suspect not. But, I mean, it, somebody may have some thoughts in that direction. The concept, which organizing concept, which interests me at the moment and which I'm engaged on writing, is the concept of the regulatory space, which was mentioned by Bob Baldwin. And here I'm going beyond the sort of Hancher and Moran formulation, where regulation is pervasive, bundled, mixed, and so on, to look at the regulatory space as a system of coordination or authority which one can talk about with its distinctive characteristics and procedures in much the same way as one can talk about the law or the market as distinctive systems of coordination. And I see certain advantages in working in that direction. It means looking at regulation across all the sectors to which it applies, not just the market, but also politics, also law, also social norms. And I think one gets a different view of the regulatory world with this cross-sectional look. Certainly, capture looks very different if one looks at it from the point of view of the relationship of regulation and politicians or regulation and the law as compared with just looking at it in the context of the market. And it means a systems approach. One's looking at regulation as a system and other systems and systems into relationships. And I think this is congruent with the move within financial analysis also to look at the financial sector as a complex system. And I don't want to prejudge whether one should look at a regulation as a complex system or just a system. But I think there is a lot of work to be done on a systems approach. And I think it also leads one to a different conclusion about things like accountability, which become extremely important. But it's not the accountability of an individual actor or for an individual act. It's an accountability, how do you keep to account, keep within the role you want, a system of coordination? How do you get the kind of regulatory system you really want? How do you get it relating to the law in a way you really want? Many of these boundaries are sort of driven by events or driven by really sort of touch and feel. There's very little consideration in a formal way as to why do we mobilise the law or why do we mobilise regulation or why do we mobilise politics or why do we mobilise regulation. So we start looking at accountability of systems and their integrity rather than the accountability in terms of individual acts. So I'm particularly attracted to the idea of developing the regulatory space as a different organising way of looking at regulatory issues. Are there other alternatives? Well, I think, as Max knows and as he alluded to, I think behavioural issues are hugely important. And the question is, is there an umbrella concept which would bring behavioural issues together in a way which would make sense in the regulatory context? One concept I'm attracted to is that put forward by Etzioni a long time ago about thinking about sources of fundamental dysfunction. That was the phrase he used, fundamental dysfunction, which means looking at failures of internalization and failures of socialization. And this is one way of looking at cognitive failure. The reasons of cognitive failure, of course, go way, way beyond what Max is talking about in terms of intellectual capture, which is a kind of herd mentality type of phenomenon. We know from Tversky and so on that cognitive failure arises from a whole number of sources. And, of course, regulators should internalize the norms of evidence-based regulation, evidence-based procedures. And if they've not internalized them, they should in some ways have been socialized, been taught them. And so I think this is one way of trying to bring together behavioral issues, cognitive issues. Why do regulators fail in a cognitive sense? So I think I would say that looking to the future, it would be very good to have some kind of framework for looking in the round at cognitive issues and questions of cognitive failure. And I'd put forward, tentatively, the Etzioni suggestion. And then I think rather more competently, I think we can usefully develop the concept of a regulatory space and think of regulation as a system and think in terms of system failures, system boundaries, as another way of looking at regulation. But I agree very much with Max that we do need some new and different type of organising concept.
Thank you very much, Frank. Very, very stimulating and forward-looking suggestions, exactly that we hope that all of our speakers will deliver. So I think we'll go through and have our four presentations and then open it up for discussion for the last section of the session. So that means we have Dr. Bettina.
And I guess it follows neatly on, because I think I'm going to partly be making a defense really for the importance of sociology and also pick up on the point about the importance of behavioral issues, so from a slightly different perspective. So what I really want to do is just make three key points. And the first one is really that I thought, in terms of thinking of new directions for regulation research, what are interesting questions as well to ask. And I thought that in terms of perhaps what the crisis as well has sort of taught us is that two specific sort of clear avenues we have for regulation, a state command and control regulation, and also the reliance on self-regulatory markets seem to have been very much discredited by regulatory failure in the context of financial services regulation. So it seemed to me that sort of perhaps one question that is really interesting to sort of foreground more really in terms of developing avenues for regulation research is really the question, how can the regulatory capacity of civil society be harnessed? And I think it very much chimes as well with points that were made in Max Watson's paper and Chris Decker's paper this morning, so that I think it fits in as well with the regulatory space idea, kind of to say that if we have a regulatory space, it can become quite important to strengthen those groups within it that can really counterbalance corporate economic interests, and as well kind of that civil society actors are those that are not necessarily affiliated with the captured politicians, the captured legislators, and potentially captured regulators. And it picks up on the point as well that Chris and Karen were talking about in strengthening consumer interests and whether it's really helpful kind of to have consumer interests represented in the state economic regulator, for example, as in the case of the utilities, or whether there should be really this very clear independence for the civil society, in this particular case consumer interest, recognized as a sort of distinct regulatory force on its own. And I think if I say sort of civil society as a regulatory force, I'm thinking about a regulatory actor really that mobilizes social norms, institutional structures, and discourses arising from the normative pursuits of citizens. And as examples, it includes non-governmental organizations and trade unions. And I think it's interesting also to think back kind of how it can include economic actors and thus seek to probe their potential for self-regulation that draws on examples of successful self-regulation of commercial chains, such as, for example, in fair trade self-regulatory regimes. And I think it's interesting as well that we can make links between asking the question, how can the regulatory capacity of civil society be harnessed, back to theoretical thinking in the field. And to look back, for example, to interesting work by an economic anthropologist and historian, Karl Polanyi, who in a classic text called The Great Transformation had this idea that there are nearly always automatic counter-regulatory movements that occur, so that over a period of time in history, we see how economic relationships become disembedded out of social relationships, and particularly in the pursuit of the myth of self-regulatory markets, but that we see cyclically how there's a counter-movement from society, how civil society reasserts itself in re-embedding economic activity and social norms. And so the key point of this work is really to understand how society is manifested in economic exchange relationships, rather than perceiving society as separate to economic activity. Captured, for instance, through the notion of a distinct public interest that regulators seek to enforce. The second point that I want to make is that the question kind of how can the regulatory capacity of civil society be harnessed is not terribly new, but I think it can given as well be a new flavor if you think about a particular disciplinary trajectory we can take in order to think about it. And so I think what's really interesting is to explore the question how the regulatory capacity of civil society can be enhanced through the lens of economic sociology literature. So in order to contribute to the mix of disciplinary traditions that can help to generate insights into causes for regulatory failure, Max and Chris, for example, made a very clear case for the importance of political economy, political science, and economics. But I think it's also important to consider the insights of economic sociology, that is, the use of sociological methods in order to explore what markets actually are and to understand more about the behavior of economic actors. In debates about the financial crisis, markets often seem to be reified as an abstract entity governed by laws of their own. But markets function within society and thus have to be understood also in terms of the wider social forces that constitute them. What, for instance, shapes the economic preferences of economic actors, and how are they mediated, for instance, by ideological belief systems? For instance, economic sociologists have made an important contribution to changing how we think about key concepts such as market failure, competition, and economic self-interest, the meaning of which is often taken for granted in traditional economic analysis. Economic sociologists, for instance, are much more skeptical of the idea of market failure and have pointed out that markets should be best understood as institutions that are often protected against failures, so various social norms and political institutions. Similarly, competition is shown not to be a natural, neutral precondition for market-based economic exchange, but revealed as a power relationship between market actors that is analyzed in detail through specific studies of competitive economic relationships. And I just want to illustrate a little bit further kind of what I think economic sociology can contribute by giving a flavor of the type of work that is being conducted by referring to an example of work from Mitchell Abulafir. He understands, for example, markets as a microcosm where economy, politics, and culture always interweave. And these microsocial systems are shown to exhibit contradictory tendencies generated by exchange relations that are resolved through power dynamics among the participants and through institutions that reflect the history of conflict in that market. Each market has its own center of gravity that creates its own culture. And the balance of contradictory tendencies in a market is specific to that market. And Abulafir discusses, for example, in particular, three pairs of contradictory tendencies that appear across many markets. He argues that these contradictory tendencies reflect the balance or tension between accumulative and regulative norms in market cultures. These include opportunism versus restraint, innovation versus standard practice, and growth versus stability. If markets were people, we might think of these as existential questions, such as, should I press my advantage in this transaction, or should I worry about my reputation and self-image? Should I try to create a better product, or should I mimic the practices of other firms in my market? Should I risk my capital by investing in my venture, or should I be happy with low risk and an acceptable level of profit? But these are not meant to be personal questions. Markets are social phenomena, and these contradictory tendencies exist at the level of the market, reflecting the predominance of either accumulative or regulative norms or scripts in that market. And such scripts are guides defining appropriate behavior in the market. Opportunism refers to the use of guile in transacting with a trading partner. The tendency to opportunism was common in early financial markets, and the threat to the traders in these markets referred to as market makers. Market makers formed associations or exchanges that made rules to keep the trading ongoing. And these rules mostly prevented the members from destroying their market by extreme opportunism, such as cornering the market and driving each other out of business. This maintained the going concern, but these rules were not designed to protect participants in the market who were not members of the exchange, i.e. outsiders who traded through brokers. There was a strong norm about fouling the nest, not destroying the stream of income, but outsider participants or the wider public who were plentiful were fair game and opportunism was rampant. Market cultures make these distinctions and enforce them. So finally, the last point I want to make, that I think it's very interesting to connect economic sociology and economic and sociology of law into the field of economic sociology of law. So regulation studies have been greatly informed by sociology of law. Detailed studies, for instance, that examine the enforcement behavior of regulatory agencies have contributed to understanding, for instance, the fine-grained detail of the low relational distance that Grabowski and Braithwaite identified as one of the causes of regulatory capture, and a point that we discussed as well this morning in the context of Max Watson's paper. I think one of the next fruitful challenges for regulation studies is to systematically combine the insights of an existing body of economic sociology as well as that of sociology of law, and the methodological tools of these two fields of inquiry in order to develop new questions in the field of regulation studies, and in particular to shed light on the regulatory capacity of civil society. An economic sociology of law works with a sociologically informed view of how law and legal actors work, with a sociologically, often empirically informed view of how economic actors operate. It brings society back into an understanding of the intersection of economic and legal behavior. And just a final example, I think, of the kind of work that this could be pointing to is that, for example, there's very interesting work starting to examine the role of trust relationships in regulatory enforcement. Petrina Schiavi, for example, has examined how mines, in order to operate successfully, need not just a legal, but also a social license. That is, the consent of members of the local community, including those who work for the mine or merely live in its vicinity. The building of trust relationships is a crucial aspect of mining companies seeking to obtain and maintain that social license. And Schiavi's work, for example, is nuanced, though, in the assessment of the potential of a social license to regulate. She also points to the importance of legal accountability mechanisms as a backstop to regulating through a social license in case trust relationships are abused. And this research further points to the need to consider trade-offs between different trust relationships. High trust relationships between regulatory authorities and regulated companies have the potential to limit trust relationships between a local community and a regulated corporation. So just to conclude, the failure of regulation is often perceived in terms of the difficulties of integrating public interest considerations into economic activity. And I think a fruitful direction for regulation research is to understand how society already informs economic activity and thus how the regulatory capacity of civil society can be further harnessed.
Thank you very much, Bettina. Very good. All right, well, we've got a cracking pace going here now. Our next is...
Let Max catch up on this. He's writing his notes.
Yes, I'm nearly there. One more word. Well,
I'm sure Alain will speak very, very quietly and slowly for Max.
Yes.
Alain.
As is the French tradition.
Yes, very much.
The floor is yours.
Anyway, I've enjoyed so much this morning and even this idea of regulatory space. And, well, so that there would be different overlaps, probably. I would say the idea of interesting future aspect or insight to be studies on regulation, what could they be? So it's in relation of my practice as well. To speak about regulatory space, it's a bit close to that. Is about to be flows and boundaries. And it touches upon utilities when you have an electron which goes from, you don't know where exactly, it goes from Britain to Germany, and it goes through air traffic when you have the planes. It goes through also environmental issues, for example, on fishy chaotic resources. There is flow of fishes. There are different possibility to see this flow from a very physical way. Planes, for example, travel from London to Palma de Mallorca. And the problem of flows is that it defines an space. A space, okay? And an airplane doesn't see when it crosses national space if there is an airspace or not, a boundary. There is no boundary, but the regulation is based on national boundaries. And there is a lot of difficulty to think the optimization of flows and building up on the national regulatory framework. In Europe, there have been a lot of regional initiatives. For example, in electricity, you've got the European regional initiatives. In air traffic control, you have the large block of airspace, which are FABs, functional airspace block, usually, which is an amalgamation, an enlarged, in fact, subset of Europe. But does not fully correspond to flows, even in electricity or else. and we'll attempt to develop a kind of regional regulation based on that. I think that has not been really properly assessed, as well as, for example, if I take the case of the fishes, where we have defined on a global world a special zone called MPA, Maritime Protected Areas. It touches upon international law, close to the national boundary of the states close to these zones. And then you have to build kind of commission, which you don't know how far they can have power or the rest. So this is a block of regulatory framework which has to deal with flows of information, flows of transaction, and where it is difficult to find the proper framework that optimizes the regulation of these flows. A second point is, I speak about Europe, how Europe is building up and at the kind of multi-level democratic way, which is striking, and perhaps Max better than I do. There are treaties, and there is an endogenous dynamics where all these lobbyist groups, that is Eurelectric, for example, which has been created in 1989, just after this white paper of 1988, to defend the interests of the electric producers. They have their voice, and they are objective by treaty of freedom of movement. As I said, there should be interoperability, interconnection. We want a space that is regulated, in fact, exactly the same for anyone. And this is done through a particular dynamics which has kind of length period, 6 or 7 years, you would say, and fully independent from political election of the member states, even if all the interests are represented. It starts with a white paper. It goes on with a communication of the Commission. It goes on with studies by the Commission that are made by consultants. It carried on with a regulatory package, and in the case of electricity, with co-decision mechanism with the Parliament, the Council of Ministers, and finally a compromise. That is usually not satisfactory, and we do another assessment, the Commission does, and we restart again. So perhaps in electricity we've got 3 regulatory packages. I think in rail, nearly 3 or 4. Something like that. So there is this endogenous dynamics which goes on the term of regulation as if it was on a linear scale with cycles. This raises the issue of, in my opinion, how this meta-European democracy develops and builds up. And I don't know if it won't be questioned at some point, but to study this internal dynamics, in my opinion, would be a very good topic. I go back to what I've been said about behavioral issues. I think behavioral science and the conduct of regulation is very important. And I don't think we've got sufficient insight or material to say when a regulator, even facing, for example, multi-decision or 1 or 2 decision, would prefer the status quo to be very, invasive or not. I think they need a new perspective in psychology or something like that. As well as I agree with the idea of complex system. You can model them through agent-based modeling or whatever, but which gives you an idea about where the systems may go according to the different way the people would behave. And I think regulation or regulator have not been studied under this kind of perspectives. There is a fourth theme which is also related to a bit of topicality about privacy, flows of information and content. You know what happened at the moment in France. Perhaps you don't know. They tried to control Twitter and Facebook on the content of the messages that everyone type, and especially about racist comment. Obviously, the French minister went to the chairman of Twitter, who laughed at him. As for Facebook as well, and said, "My dear, my poor, do you think we are very specially for you?" But this is an invasiveness, and all the information system on the privacy, on what and which content should be regulated or not. And for the future, I think there is a need to pay certain attention to that. On the same ground, we see computing clouds, hybrid organization that have a lot of information, private or not public, and which are difficult sometimes to ownership, private ownership or not. It is difficult, in fact, to know exactly how they use it, how they make use it, how they need to be regulated. Probably on my computer, my IP, many knows everything and what I can read, not read. And in this way, the issue is, does it exist a way to define kind of barriers in the making use of this private information? And the fifth topic I have selected is technology and science. It's very, very strange. If you take the genetics, which allows a lot of things now, even for homosexual married people, to buy the womb of a woman with genetic sperm or whatever. All the things you can do with that, or even, let's say you've got a heart problem and you go to your doctor and he has identified your genes because it was in the family, but unfortunately now the machine gives you all the spectrum of your genes and can tell that probably, you risk to have also an intestine cancer. Let me say you come to visit me and I am the doctor. Do I tell you everything or not? And with a kind of probability, and when you will exit my room, in which kind of psychological, state you will be. Here again, there is a problem of, in my opinion, a problem of information, use of information, and if, for example, I have not told you that you are going probably to have the cancer in 20 years' time, and you say, I come back to you, and I say, I sue you, So I think that technology and science will raise a lot of questions, even on special data use. And the 6 points, and I will stop there, is about enforcement. Because we have talked about regulation. Sometimes we said in the US, they just jail them, so that make them a bit more sensible to what they risk. But the big banker, they have not been being responsible for what it is. Enforcement, deterrence of current sanctions, and dilution of responsibility. That's what we are observing in the failure, in the different case of failure, in my opinion, of regulation. And particularly, the difficulty with the private sector to make them pay for their negative externalities and to single them out and find the proper law framework, or I don't know, sanctioning framework, that would benefit greatly, in my opinion, for society.
Thank you very much, Alain. So, Kira, you have the floor.
Okay, so, well, since I just put together my points as everyone was talking, so I was trying to write them while I'm listening to everyone, probably be a little bit shorter and not quite as well scoped out. So I think picking up a little bit on some of Alain's points, especially his point about interconnectedness and flows and things, I think, you know, today's discussions have been extremely interesting, but I think not unusual in the sense that we tend to, and I've noticed especially when I'm on this side of the pond as opposed to my home side of the pond, be talking a lot about kind of national level independent regulators in our context of regulation, which is obviously a very important question, but it doesn't span the entire kind of framework of regulation for a variety of reasons, and I think it has to do with the increasing interconnectedness of regulation. And some of this was discussed earlier when we talked about the expansion of scope, right? So going from in utilities regulations, who now have to take social things into account and sustainable development into account, we also have this increasing interconnectedness between, say, countries. So on the EU context, we have EU level regulation. We have to get those electrons flowing, we have to have regulators from different countries talking to each other. And then we have this other interaction, which is that regulators from different areas, scopes, energy, environment, et cetera, are also mm-hmm. hitting interconnected ways. And if that weren't making it all difficult enough, that's just thinking in our kind of traditional regulator sense. But what we also have, and I come from the lens of sustainable development, is that a lot of what's happening around dealing with issues of climate change, issues of natural resource consumption, is happening in very global regulatory networks that are more or less voluntary, right? Maybe voluntary third party in name, but maybe less optional in actual character in some cases more so. I mean, I think Frank made a really important point about kind of the failure of the risk regulation paradigm as well. So you have markets have been left to deal with these transboundary issues, and maybe the whole concept of risk-based regulation hasn't kept up with the problem space. So we have this problem spaces, we have all these different levels. And so we have, I think what we need to think about more is understanding these connections between different issues and how that changes our tools. So if, for example, in these frameworks where we have to deal with multiple, decision-making on multiple attributes, and we're moving beyond kind of these risk-based frameworks, what does that mean? So, for example, in the U.S., the U.S. EPA and now several other branches of the U.S. government who have various environmental bits and pieces in their remit are thinking about this idea of sustainability impact assessment, which is a very big change from a risk-based assessment paradigm that's been very strongly embedded in administrative practice in the U.S. And this comes from some OECD work, but it's much more theoretical than practical at this point, and there's very open questions about how this is going to slam into different tools that are statutorily required or are customary and what this means for expertise. So as we try to grapple with changes in the space, with increasing connections between issues and levels and agencies, how are we going to have these conflicts and how are we going to better understand how we can grapple with them, right? So how do the energy regulators operate in a world where they also have to be thinking about the potential carbon trading regimes and all these other things that are popping up. And I think that, so I guess my point that I'm going to keep talking about a little bit is that the interactions between regulatory systems are not very well understood. And I think it's especially fascinating. I've started to do some work personally, and I've noticed there's not much written around when you start talking about voluntary systems interacting with more classical regulatory systems. So first, we tended to conceptualize them as things that appeared in a vacuum, right? Spaces where there was no one else doing things. Except there really is no such thing as a regulatory vacuum anywhere in the world, right? There may be stronger systems and weaker systems, but there's very rarely nothing going on. And so then what you begin to see, if you drill down a little bit and start to study kind of some of these longer-lived systems, you see these interesting phenomenon where it becomes almost either a co-regulating system or a system of, you've actually seen classical regulators take over voluntary regulations, organic in the U.S. being kind of a prime example of a very competitive, fuzzy, voluntary space that the government came in and said, we're taking this over and we're going to say what's in this voluntary standard, right? We're going to become the regulator here. It's going to be voluntary. But kind of even more interesting to me are these cases where governments either require the use of a voluntary program. For example, Bolivia requiring FSC certification for forests instead of putting up their own regulations, the EU having certain standards on sustainable biofuels, which are satisfied by adherence to a voluntary regulation, right, which is this taking our authority and abdicating some of it into these systems, which have a very different accountability set. And so those interactions, I think, are understudied and are quite interesting. And then, a key question there is, how does the accountability change? What are the impacts of that? How do we set up accountability systems that can take these very different ways of putting regulations together into account? Because there is no classical democratic accountability. They have Julia Blackwer here. She, you know, has written extensively on some of these issues around accountability and voluntary schemes. But even then, when these systems come together, how does that change the picture of what we know about regulatory systems and when we start having them kind of happening this way on transboundary? Which leads to another kind of question, is that as this space changes, we also don't have a great understanding of which tools to always use at which problem points or which points in time or at which levels, right? What works in what situations? Where is it appropriate to have voluntary, and where do we need to step in with more classical regulatory systems? Which very much mirrors the debate about actually what the regulatory systems have been themselves, say, in finance, right? Where is it appropriate for it to be the market, and where is it appropriate for it to be, more directed? But I think that then we have this question on this bigger scale in these spaces where we have even more actors. So it's not just what's our ideology about how to regulate, but who is regulating, who has the authority. If northern consumption patterns are impacting the environment in a developing country, who steps in, right? Who decides on the choices? Who decides how we value things? Who's benefiting and who's paying in those situations? It gets very complex. Are some of these standards that are coming out good models for balancing social and technical demands in when we have multiple goals? So one thing that they have been an interesting locus for is innovation. So we, in the U.S. regulatory writing, for example, for a very long time, we've talked about the role of state-level regulators as the potential for kind of having lots and lots and lots of hedging, right, across our regulatory strategies. So they might be able to be a little more innovative. You can try a bunch of different things, and then things might trickle up, and some of them get dropped, right? And it's kind of the state as the laboratory, and then the U.S. federal kind of comes in much slower, and it changes slower. But it has lots of things to draw on. The same thing can be said for voluntary certification vis-a-vis kind of other roles, and especially in experimenting with how we deal with multiple actors, multiple geographies, and different tools. But there's also a technical side to this in the sense that there's a community of people who kind of see these as panaceas, and I personally don't think that they fix a lot of problems in and of themselves, but what they do is demonstrate particular technologies, particular approaches, create niches, create markets for things, so that, for example, with if you take green building, 15 years ago, you couldn't have green building requirements in local building regulations because you didn't have architects who knew how to do it, you didn't have engineers who knew how to do it, and you didn't have products on the market that would be available to you and I to have, put paint on the wall and insulation in our roof. And the service that LEED has provided isn't so much that X number of buildings now use X amount less energy. It's that now you or I or anyone else can go out and have access to a whole bunch of products and a whole bunch of capacity, and that you can start to build these things into regulations. So they provide a space for both experimentation and innovation on how to regulate, but also they provide space to actually build technical capacity to regulate. They can also build technical capacity for, say, auditing and enforcement in places where it didn't exist before, because the creation of organizations that go around and do the auditing in these countries then begins to build a community of people who are able to do that. And all of a sudden, you may be able to put a regulatory sphere into place. So kind of the role of these not necessarily new, but still quite emerging systems as a step in a regulatory process in places where regulation has traditionally been difficult is something that I think that we haven't really thought about a lot. And it's begun to become increasingly important. Let's see. And I think another thing to think about as we think about all these different areas, be they financial, be they energy, whatever, is that this kind of final word on the interconnectedness is that the links are horizontal, right, and they're vertical, so we have kind of European multi-level governance, we have across, and we also have diagonal. So one of the things that I think is really interesting is in the world of chemicals, there's been kind of an exchange of ideas and concepts and strategy from state level in places like Maine up to EU reach, completely bypassing the intermediate. Or you have some of these climate regional agreements with a city here and a country there. And so even defying our traditional ideas of horizontal and vertical and you know, 3 points on the globe at completely different levels and scales, cooperating, exchanging ideas is something else to kind of, if we're looking from a very large perspective, you know, what are the pros and cons of that, and what might we be able to learn about attacking problems if we don't assume, you know, that the linkages are going to either be, you know, EU, country, state, province, city, or they're going to be England, France, Germany, right, in that way, that they might actually be mega city to small country.
Thank you very much, Kira. Yeah. Good. Well, we have four presentations, each offering some interesting suggestions, some overlap, undoubtedly, there. But who would like to perhaps take the floor, take up one or other, Max? That was a nod, I think.
It was really a jolt, but yes.
He's trying not to fall asleep.
Guilty start.
Well, the others are getting their thoughts together, Max. I know you're a step ahead.
I can read my own handwriting with others can't. This is an asymmetry of information not to be neglected. I just had a few really rather dispersed thoughts. One was, in a way, what Kiris may be pointing towards is action within the regulatory space as a learning system, and in a sense, experimentation. I was also struck by the US example of states experimenting, and you can see examples of that in Europe. So they're learning systems, and within the regulatory space, you do also have a much more interaction between an industry, if it's an industry, and the regulator. And Chris and I were discussing in the coffee break that it isn't just in finance that you get this dance, this regulatory arbitrage. You get companies in the utility sector, Chris was saying, redefining their regulated areas and their ring fencing so as to change the pricing, just as banks move activities around to change the capital charge. So this is a very different way of thinking about regulation. It's not single industry, single regulator, static regulation. It's completely different, and different styles of regulation. And that's one of the big things I take away from today. And I think the other thing, I think it's sort of layer on what you're saying, and I want to go back to one point in my paper. When you look at an industry, and I'll take finance, but I don't think it's just finance, and you think of the way the government shapes the industry for its own policy objectives or in some ill-defined version of the public interest, we think of its set of legal regulations specific to the industry, but actually there may be other aspects of government activity that powerfully shape the industry, and that the obvious case in finance is the way you manage economic policy is dramatic for the industry and it feeds back. And I think when we look at the regulatory space, one has to imagine government's actions being not just the rule book with the right heading in it. It may be there's another rule book that is greatly impacting this. Two other short comments. I think I very, very strongly agree with this question about understanding behavior and what shapes preferences. And I'm reminded of Alan Drazen at the University of Maryland was asked, why do you talk about political economy? I remember my program on financial markets is called The Political Economy of Financial Markets. What is political economy? Is that Scottish for economy, basically? And God say, Adam Smith was a coiner of this phrase. And Alan Drazen looked up, he said, you really haven't got this at all. Economics is about optimizing behavior, and political economy is about why people don't optimize. And I thought, this is a very fundamental question. What are risk preferences? They're just not what conventional economics necessarily assumes. So you have to look. That's one reason risk-based regulation was hazardous in the market. And so that question, what shapes preferences, I think one has to come back to. Last comment. In the way people have thought about economic policy for the last 20 years, a great influence is a guy called Tinbergen, and a character from the Netherlands, who said one instrument, one goal. So you take the interest rate, you affect inflation. And people took that as a justification of what an agency did, like the Bank of England, for example, and thought, well, agencies have to have single goals. And no, I actually went back and read what he said, and he said at some point, nobody would ever be so silly as to suggest that the central bank would have the sole object of inflation. This would be hugely destabilizing. But any instrument has to have one goal, logically, and then you have to think how to coordinate instruments to achieve agency goals. I think regulation, there are some analogies to this, that one has to think narrow instruments have a narrow goal, but an agency doesn't necessarily have a narrow goal. But when we think of accountability, it's as if we need a subroutine, and Chris that sort of says, okay, let's pick up the gas industry. We look at the economic regulation aspect and say, is it doing this well? We don't confuse that question with the social and distributional issue, but it may be there's a second level of the analysis, which is environmental. But there is, in regulatory impact analysis, you kind of have a 6 or 7 stage process. And I think you need to separate out the goals in this process. And the real confusion arises when you try to solve it all in a big simultaneous equation.